Thanks to Neil and the other organisers for this invitation to Perimeter and a chance to talk about these interesting things. This has been quite a trip down memory lane for me in many ways, like seeing some of the old guard like Claudio from Quantum Gravity. So in honour of this trip down memory lane, I thought I'd deliver the talk on this ancient visualizer. So thanks to the Perimeter AV people for digging that out of the very back of the cupboard. I'm sorry?
Very soft.
Speak louder.
A bit louder, okay. So I'm going to talk about some quantum mechanical aspects of quantum cosmology. I have felt for many years that there's more cosmology than quantum in quantum cosmology. So the bulk of this talk will be addressing that, specifically quantum mechanical aspects of quantum cosmology. And this has largely come from an ongoing collaboration with Jim Hartle and Tom Hertog, which was largely in response to the work of Neil and collaborators recently. I would also, towards the end, like to talk about some other quantum aspects of quantum cosmology, which is based on a PhysRevD paper from 2009, which is about just bringing a somewhat more mathematical structure to how we build a predictive framework in quantum cosmology. Now, Claudio started his talk with a quote from Winston Churchill on Monday morning, and I'd like to do the same. Neil also said on Monday morning he'd like people to be honest about what they don't understand. And I was reminded of this quote by Winston Churchill, who said, "I have often been made to eat my own words and have found them to be a most nutritious meal." So perhaps at the end of the meeting, some of us are going to be having a very tasty meal. So in quantum cosmology, one can identify two different attitudes to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation and the path integral. So first of all, in the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, people say that one can perceive there's an attitude that the wave function is just a solution to the differential equation. But a more elaborate attitude would be to say that psi is an eigenstate of a self-adjoint operator, H. And likewise, in the path integral, one often encounters the attitude that the path integral is somehow a standalone object. But a more sophisticated view would be that it's tied to the Hilbert space, must be demonstrably tied to the Hilbert space structure of quantum mechanics. Now, as you can guess, I'm focusing on attitude B in both of these cases. I think actually few people are really hugely tied to attitude A, but on the other hand, I see a lot of sort of path integral and Wheeler-DeWitt type work which isn't really very clear about what the quantum mechanical structure actually is. So what I'm going to do in this talk is to try to elucidate that to some degree. So let's talk then about Wheeler-DeWitt quantization, just sort of putting down the proper proper formalism. So I imagine already we're in a mini superspace situation. So we've got coordinates with a scalar factor, scalar field, and so on. And we have a wave function satisfying the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, Laplacian operator in an indefinite signature with a potential. And one can think about then what sort of inner products might we want to associate with these wave functions. Well, there's the Schrödinger inner product, which is positive, but isn't, as it stands, naturally associated with this sort of equation. Wheeler-DeWitt equation is more naturally associated with the Klein-Gordon equation, but that can, however, it's as negative as often as it is positive. So neither of these immediately are the correct inner product. But the correct inner product for the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is the one mentioned already by Claudio, called the induced inner product, or perhaps related to this Stackelberg inner product. And the simplest way to describe it is as follows, that we look at eigenstates of the Wheeler-DeWitt operator with eigenvalue E degeneracy K, and then we overlap them in the Schrödinger inner product. And then we will get delta functions on the eigenvalues of the degeneracy, and from which you see if E is E prime, then that's divergent. So the mod psi squared norm would be divergent. But the induced inner product is simply to drop the delta function on the eigenvalues and then define what's left to be the induced inner product. So that's in a very plain way, have the property, you can normalize them in that way. I mean, that looks a bit informal, but it can be made quite rigorous. And in practice, you just regularize things by working with eigenstates of the Wheeler-DeWitt operator and dropping delta functions where appropriate. And that gives us a nice, well-defined positive inner product. In particular, in relativistic quantum mechanics in flat Minkowski space, induced inner product gives two Klein-Gordon inner products with a sign tweak to make sure that it's positive. So it's positive on the plus sign for the positive frequencies, minus sign for the negative frequencies. So that makes everything work out rather nicely. Now, of course, in looking at a spectrum here, I'm assuming that the Wheeler-DeWitt operator is a self-adjoint operator. So let us look at that. And I'm going straight away to the de Sitter mini-superspace model that's been discussed all week. So we have a metric parameterized in this way using this variable q, which is the square of the scale factor, and this convenient 1 over q here, which makes things very simple. And then the Wheeler-DeWitt equation for this symptom, this system has the following simple form. It's got this annoying 12 pi to the fourth in there. Guys, if you put a scaling in front of the metric, you can get rid of all these factors of pi and so on. It's really makes it a lot easier. Otherwise, all the calculations are a lot more messy. Anyway, that aside, this is the Wheeler-DeWitt equation we want to solve for this system. But a point that is sometimes but rarely noticed in studies in quantum cosmology is that we're dealing with a positive 3 metric here, positive definite 3 metric. And in particular, Q is positive. So you're actually doing quantum mechanics on the positive real line. So this is a quantum mechanical point that needs to be addressed. And I've seen, of the hundreds of papers in quantum cosmology, that I've really only seen a handful that actually acknowledge this particular point. So if you're on the positive real line, how do you make sure the Hamiltonian is self-adjoint? Well, you stick this in the inner product, you do the integration by parts. You find that the current has to vanish at q equals naught. And that will be the case if and only if the wave, some combination of the wave function and its derivative actually vanishes at q equals naught for some real number b. It can be anything. I'm excluding b equals zero because that means you can't then have a no-boundary situation. You can't propagate from zero. So this you have to keep in mind when you're actually doing slightly more rigorous things with quantum cosmology. And this will have some interesting consequences, actually. So one has to impose quantum mechanical boundary conditions at q equals naught.
So, you're excluding v equals zero for what reason?
Well, when you construct the propagation amplitude from zero to a final geometry, it's zero if psi naught is naught. So that's not so interesting.
So a
free parameter enters, yes.
But usually you would just put a wall, right, at q equal to zero.
Right.
So which would require the derivative to vanish, so that psi would be an odd function of q.
Well, there's one parameter family of choices.
I mean, so that's b equals infinity.
Yeah. I mean, that seems to be different than having a b.
This is the most general. If you open a quantum mechanics book about quantum mechanics on restricted ranges, this is the standard picture. That there's a one-parameter family.
You have to allow B to be infinite.
That's fine.
Yeah.
But not just infinite.
Yeah.
Another question is: do you really need H to be self-adjoint? Because in the end, you only have zero spectrum.
That's veering towards the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is just a differential equation point of view. So I would say yes.
You want to be
I want H to be self-adjoint. So let's talk about path integrals, which is what this workshop's about. Part of my pleasant trip down memory lane was being reminded of Claudio's papers 30 years ago. How to construct wave functions out of path integrals in this form. So we've seen this path integral construction for the wave function a few times this week. You integrate n over some contour. For all the de Sitter mini superspace model, this is the form of the action, simple linear system. The no boundary proposal says q naught is naught, and then we integrate to final points which match some value q1. And I can just do the integral. Functional integral over q is just a standard quantum mechanical one, and it has this sort of form. 1 over n to the half, and then a phase where this is s is just now a function of n. And then you can actually, in this integral, as we've seen already this week, you can do the n integral over a number of different contours and get various different results, perhaps real ones, perhaps complex, whatever your preference is. But this ignores so far this requirement to have Q positive. So that has to enter in there somewhere. I mean, one could imagine getting reflected paths of Q equals naught or something like that. Another point here as well is that a lot of the discussion around this gets quite focused on the mathematical techniques of Picard-Lefschetz theory to make sense of what this is. But it's interesting to try and just do this integral in a completely different way, so you can perhaps get a completely different perspective. And that relates to what I've said already about quantum mechanical structure and also restricting to Q equals naught. So here's another way of doing the path integral. So same expression again, integral over n, quantum mechanical path integral, and I'm going to do the thing we used to do in the old days, which is to cover up. Thing that Bill Inriu used to complain about. So this is just to get you focused on a key point here. So now in quantum mechanics, this is just an ordinary non-relativistic style path integral. But if I really have a quantum mechanical formalism here, it must be an object of this type. It's e to the I minus inh of a self-adjoint operator sandwiched between two configuration space eigenstates. So I can then expand this in the eigenstates of H using the spectral theorem. So let's do that. I'm going to take the contour to be the entire real line, purely real contour, and just writing this in the standard formula, you see it's just a sum over the eigenvalues, e to the minus ine, and then these are just eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. Now I can do the n-integral, so it's undeniably a real Lorentzian integral. I don't have to decide, do I go this way or that way, or this saddle point or singularity. It's just unambiguous result. And I clearly get delta E, and then I just do the summation over E, and I just get a sum of the E equals naught eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. So it clearly satisfies the Willard-Witt equation. So it's one very clear way of implementing this idea of a real Lorentzian path integral. Now, when you do it by contours, you get lots of different answers. So how do I get lots of different answers here? Well, the answer is about the boundary conditions on U. I've not said what they are yet, necessarily. Obviously, if you're restricting to Q positive, you would choose the one parameter family that I mentioned. So the point here is that a real Lorentzian contour can actually give one of many solutions, the Willard-Witt equation, depending on the boundary conditions that you choose, at Q equals naught. So in de Sitter mini superspace model, for instance, if I take U naught as minus U prime naught, I get the tunneling wave function at small q. If I take U as U prime, as Thomas mentioned yesterday, you get Hartle-Hawking type wave function at small q. So you can get different results for the same contour just by choosing these different boundary conditions. You have to make a choice in order to respect this q greater than zero prescription restriction. Now, what does that correspond to in contour language? Well, supposing, as many people have done, you just ignore the restriction to q positive in the path integral. In order to match the boundary conditions at q equals naught, what you would have to do is to take the wave function to be not a single contour integral, but actually a sum of different contour integrals over different contours. And that is pretty evident from the models that you do. That does actually give you the same sort of result. So again, these boundary conditions that you have to impose at q equals naught tells you that what you really ought to be doing is summing the results of different contours, unless you could do the sum in such a way that it corresponded to one quite complicated contour that might be possible in some circumstances. So this sort of new freedom might actually help in resolving some of the difficulties that Neil and collaborators have brought forwards. And those difficulties relate to matter fluctuations. If we add scalar field or gravitational wave fluctuations, then the path integral analysis, perimeter institute analysis, yields wave functions of this form, crucially for the scalar fields, they actually have exponentially growing or exponentially decaying modes. Now, armed with this slightly more sophisticated quantum mechanical formalism, I can ask questions about this. Is this actually consistent with the normalization? Is it okay to get e to the plus phi squared? Well, naively, I would have thought yes, because, well, that could just be an approximation to a wave function like that. And in fact, a more detailed mode function analysis of analogous systems, which I could show someone later on, shows that you can build the wave function from completely normalizable mode functions and still get exactly this, a small phi. So this is an approximation to a normalizable wave function. Now, furthermore, you can actually choose mode functions and contours so that the contribution from these sorts of saddle points is actually zero. So there are some boundary conditions you can choose. Even if we can't sort out between us all our contour stories, you can pick some boundary conditions so that these things with their unhappy consequences are actually just sidestepped completely. Now, actually, I will skip the more detailed calculation in the interest of finishing on time. So coming on to the second part of the talk then. Now, how quantum cosmology is normally interpreted is using a heuristic method called WKB interpretation, where you suppose that the wave function is of this form, or maybe a sum of that form, sum of wave functions in that form. And then you might be interested in what's the probability of going through some region of mini superspace, or a series of regions, or following a trajectory, or something like that. So we've got basically a bunch of classical paths with measure mod c squared. How do we compute this probability? Well, it's pretty straightforward, actually, that does a trajectory enter or not enter a region? Well, it depends on how much flux it has over the boundary. And it's pretty obviously just the integral of this current, basically, over the boundary regions where the flux is ingoing. So that's a pretty natural classical interpretation that is used in many practical circumstances to make predictions. But the question is, can I get this from a more quantum mechanical perspective? Well, to do this sort of calculation, I need a bit more structure. We need observables in quantum cosmology. Well, we have reparametrization invariants, so that means our observables, such as some operator A, must commute with the Wheeler-DeWitt operator. And it's been known for a long time how to build these sorts of things. If I take, for instance, the integral of some operator B over the parameter time T, then that will commute with H. Less well known is you can also take infinite products of these things. If I take this to be a projection operator or POVM, by taking an infinite product using similar arguments, I can argue that this thing actually will commute with a Hamiltonian. These two constructions, they classically correspond to the idea that the operator A is a function of an entire classical path. That's the only sort of reparametrization invariant notion. Armed with this sort of understanding, I can scribble down an expected answer to this quantum cosmology question of the WKB interpretation. And it looks something like this. This is not the final answer, I'm just doing this in two steps. So we have some region of mini superspace, and I can construct a projector onto that region. And then in a Heisenberg picture, I can look at P dot, which is just P comma H basically. And that actually, P dot is basically the flux going in or out of that region. And I can, perhaps with some sort of operator ordering maneuvering, I can split P dot into an ingoing and an outgoing part. So the ingoing flux and the outgoing flux on a given surface sigma. One of the big stories in quantum gravity is that you can't do this in general. You can't, in quantum cosmology, you can't foliate the whole mini superspace into a family of surfaces where there's a clear definition of positive and negative flux. But if I'm only doing it on one surface, then it's not necessarily an obstruction. And that's exactly what I'm doing here. And then using this P dot, I look at the ingoing flux and I define this object. I integrate this over, shift this in time, and then integrate. And what is that? Well, it's what I call the ingoing intersection number. And classically speaking, it's 1 for paths that enter and 0 for paths don't. So it's a quantum mechanical analog, therefore, of this. And because it has this integrated over time form, that will commute with the Hamiltonian. So that's a very useful observable, which is fine as long as the paths don't do too much wiggling around on the boundary. And then the probability of entering the region is just the average of this object in the given state, the given solution to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, and this coincides actually with the WKB flux. So that's the sort of expected answer that a more sophisticated quantum theory would give you. Okay, so how do I get something like that? By doing path integrals and decoherent histories and that sort of thing. Well, I'm not going to give anything like a full-blown decoherent histories analysis, but let's just look at a path integral approach to defining entering a region or not. This is one of the first things that was tried, that you have a path integral of the familiar form with an integral over the lapse function, and you compute the amplitude to go from an initial to final point with all paths entering the region delta. And likewise, you can look at the amplitude for never entering. You sum over paths that are always outside this region delta. This is a sort of natural thing to try, but it turned out there are two problems with this. One is that when you operate on the amplitude, you might have thought you'd get a solution to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, but you don't. It's actually non-zero on the boundary. And it's to do with how things change as you move from inside to outside the boundary. And it's to do with the fact that I'm not looking at entire infinite histories, just chunks of histories. The other problem with this, and this actually also relates to Raphael's talk this morning, and that is, who was also looking at regions. Looking at regions in this way, the problems with the Zeno effect. If I actually want to say in quantum mechanics that this path is always on the outside of a region, it's like I have to keep monitoring it continually in time. And that will just bounce off any trajectories that try to enter. So that's actually quite a serious problem with some of these path integral constructions, a quantum mechanical aspect that often doesn't get the attention that it deserves. Well, there are ways around both of these things. Now, we're approaching the end in good time. Instead of looking at this typical path integrals where you sum over paths, I switched attention some years ago to looking at class operators, which are more or less amplitudes defined by, they're really strings of projectors, in fact, is what we use in decoherent histories. Supposing I look at a projector onto the outside of this region delta, and I do this thing of producting over an infinite number of physical times. So that commutes with the Hamiltonian. It's an observable. It is unphysical because of the Zeno effect, because I'm just projecting onto the outside of the region all the time. Well, we know how to deal with that in quantum mechanics. You just have to soften the projectors. So you replace the P bar with a P over M. So you're not actually banning the paths from entering. You're just saying if you do enter, there's a penalty. So they get suppressed for entering. But there's a trade-off between how accurately you can detect it and whether or not you get the Zeno effect. But if you measure it softly enough, you can get the information without actually having everything bounce off. Now, this is all spelled out at length in my paper, but the bottom line is this comparatively simple formula that the class operator for not entering turns out to look like this. I mean, the heart of it is this propagation, but it involves a complex absorbing potential. That, in effect, is the P over M. So any paths that actually enter that get suppressed by a complex potential. And then I do that between finite times. And clearly, I could represent that thing by an ordinary non-relativistic path integral, except what I do here is stick unitary evolutions on the end and then let the t's go off to infinity, and the resulting object commutes with h. And you might also recognize that, in fact, as an S matrix. And it's, even though it has a V in here, an S matrix actually commutes with h in this limit. Sorry?
Why does V?
It doesn't.
Oh, I thought you said this object
commutes with h. But this thing commutes with h. And when I calculate it, it turns out to be an S matrix, which commutes with h.
So even though V does not?
Correct.
How does that?
So the standard property of the S matrix. It's to do, if just tracing back, it's because you've got this infinite product over time.
By H, do you mean the H including the
D? No. That's it traces back to this. You see, if I apply unitary evolution operators with H on this thing, it just shifts the T along a bit. And then I just rescale T and shift T and I absorb it. So it is similar to the way in which the usual integral over N gives you a solution to the Willi-Dewitt equation. But these are new types of objects that I think are quite interesting to look at in quantum gravity, that you can meet reparameterization invariance without having to do integrals over N. And then finally, using objects of this type, you can then calculate the probability for not entering the region. It's the we have an initial state, which I can still generate by a path integral if I want, in the old way, but the probability is then just C dagger C. That's a now standard quantum mechanical formula, and at great length, one can show it gets back to the ingoing intersection number and the usual WKB interpretation. So you can get the standard quantum mechanical results using a sort of more sophisticated formalism where you have proper inner product operators commuting with the constraint, and so on. So that is essentially it. But my two key points are, first of all, path integrals of this form that we've been discussing all week are not uniquely defined without quantum mechanical boundary conditions. And especially looking at what happens at Q equals naught, by imposing the right conditions, we could perhaps avoid some of the problems. And secondly, when you look at in quantum cosmology at the objects you're actually interested in, probabilities for entering a region, you're led to other types of objects, other types of path integral, which are not in general of that form. So that's all. Thank you.
Yesterday we were promised during Tom's talk that you would explain the boundary conditions you're imposing in this.
Yeah. That is exactly this.
But which of those? That's a whole one-parameter family. Are you imposing one of those, or are you?
You choose it to avoid Neil's problem. So what I wrote down this. So if you impose that condition, you get tunneling wave function.
Okay.
But I anticipate the correct condition is going to be this one, which seems to lead U as U prime. That's what Tom mentioned yesterday. That gives the pure Hartle-Hawking at small geometries. I mean, loosely speaking, if you take the contour that Neil and collaborators took, take the full infinite one, so you're looking at the real part of G, and then you take a linear combination of that, the one that we took, and you can then rule out the exponentially growing phi squareds, the terms we think should cancel out.
Well, in the BIQ9 model that I discussed, it's automatic because they're not even on a single end lobe space.
Right.
But you seem to be saying by imposing different conditions on the background, you'll fix all the perturbations. Is that right? Are you going to change the initial conditions on the perturbations too?
That's less problematic because the perturbations sit in infinite range. And you'd want the perturbation wave functions to be normalizable, and that would probably fix the boundary conditions. But the scale factor, or the Q, has this special property that it has to be positive. So conditions are one parameter family of conditions required at Q equals naught.
Well, if you think about the boundary proposal, the way we've tried to implement it, which is that you have some initial three geometry, which you then take the limit at zero size.
Yep.
You still have to specify what are the perturbations on that initial three geometry.
Right.
So we simply imposed finite action.
Right.
And found that everywhere in the complex plane, except on the branch cuts, that prescribed which mode was relevant, which complex classical solution was relevant. So the question is, how are you going to determine which complex classical solution you use for the perturbation?
You think it's still ongoing at the moment, but the solution will be to find the mode functions when you've got Q and phi going on. And I strongly suspect what happens is that I think this case in when you solve for the mode functions, e to the minus q is very tied to the e to the plus phi squared. I think that is going to be the answer. To be determined.
Well, one of the scale factors that I discussed yesterday is like a perturbation.
Right.
And we clearly impose no boundary conditions on that perturbation.
Meaning that it's zero initially or what?
Yes, that's what I showed yesterday. Both scale factors, they're zero initially.
The case Tom had yesterday, there was two scale factors, P and Q, and they both had to be positive. Because they were, and therefore you've got two positive real line. You've got quantum mechanics in the positive quadrant, and you need two boundary conditions on both boundaries.
Intuitively, one of these scale factors is just like the perturbation that you have in your paper, and the boundary conditions on it are exactly the same.
So maybe I could just make a comment.
Yeah.
Unless anyone else has a question, I don't want to hog the discussion. But if just a brief comment. I mean, I think what I have in mind, you say this restriction Q positive. If we trace that back, that comes from a restriction that the determinant, you know, the root minus G.
It's more than that. It's HIJ must have positive eigenvalues.
Right, so the determinant of the three metric should be positive.
Yes.
Right. So another way to ensure that condition is to write the three metric in terms of frame fields, field lines. And then when you write the action, it would be just the determinant of the frame field without any root. So the advantage of that formulation is that the action is analytic in all variables. You know, if you impose Q bigger than zero, you're basically saying the action is not analytic in the dynamical variables. So what the formulation I prefer is that you write an action which is explicitly analytic in all variables. Now the difficulty is that actually for the lambda model to solve it, it's easier to go to Q. But if you formulate it in terms of the frame variables in which the action is analytic, there would be no such requirement for Q positive. So
I have a response.
There is
to
a
that.
Picture. Yeah. There is a picture in which you would avoid any need for such restriction.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
The restriction to Q positive. That's one manifestation of the story. So, I mean, you might say, well, it's here's another way of fixing the problem. Perhaps you write Q equals e to the x and say, oh, look, now x is. On an infinite range.
That's
now,
what Carrier does.
Why does that not work? let me tell you. The thing is, if you go back now to the Wheeler-Dritt equation, it changes the potential.
Yes.
You then get an exponentially steep potential, and when you shoot particles at an exponentially steep potential, they can bounce back like a hard wall. And see, the issue with the hard wall is that there's more than one path. There's a straight path from there to there, and there's ones that bounce off. And you can get the same effect with a very steep potential. It doesn't have to have a hard wall. So when you start doing tricks like this to solve the problem, it comes back at you.
That's right.
Maybe I
can.
I wanted to comment on the frame field, because if you do that, indeed Q is positive. But then you can have a positive and negative orientation of the frame field. Mm-hmm. And that has a lot to do with summing over orientation or not, and is related to positive or negative laps in some sense, if you want.
Yes, yes,
and
yes.
Indeed, very naturally, if you do like Palatini, which is a kind of frame field, you do sum over orientations and have these effects I described that you cannot distinguish between inside and outside. So you do solve this problem, negative laps actually.
I actually think it's a crease in the carpet, this sort of problem.
Sorry, which problem?
Well, there's about Q positive. I remember over the years trying to.
You're saying it's a crease in the carpet?
A crease in the carpet, meaning you can move it around, but you can't squash it flat.
Oh, okay.
Unremovable problem. I'm guessing yes. Okay.
Just a comment about.
I think let's ask Claudia.
Sure.
So I would like to make a remark first. Although, as all of us do, I also love mini superspace. I grew up with mini superspace. But mini superspace is a dangerous ground. And because it may miss things, clearly many things of the whole theory. But on the other hand, one wants to get some results, so one has to go in. So what we did in the past was to try to do something that could look like a mini superspace, but hopefully would retain some important properties from the big theory. So this thing that I presented in the first lecture is old stuff, but one can do something which is effectively done also in this mini superspace, which is eliminate from the constraint, from the Hamiltonian constraint, the curvature term. That's, I think, also done here.
Right.
But yes. To eliminate it, but don't do anything else, and so keep the six components of the metric.
This is the ultra-local theory.
Yes.
Right.
Well, maybe I'm taking too long to explain it. So this ultra-local theory has the virtue that, as a theory in itself, it is not truncated.
Yes.
So that's a good thing with respect to a mini superspace, which is truncated. But of course, it's a different theory. And the idea was to approach the full theory by a perturbation expansion around that theory, which is not truncated. Now, in that theory, which is not truncated, one can read it precisely. So one has the GIJ, and one takes, not as a trick, but really in a well-defined way, that Q equals to e to the it, where the Q is the determinant of GIJ. And that works very well because one can calculate, so one can write the Wheeler-DeWitt operator as some operator which is minus d2 over d tau 2, if you call tau the thing that is in the exponent of E there, plus a piece with a cosmological constant, and that operator has eigenfunctions which go like e to the I omega t and also e to the minus I omega t, and so which are Hankel functions, so that takes into account explicitly the business of the barrier that you were mentioning. It's taking into account properly the thing, I mean, works well. You use the properties of Hankel functions, but they are both there. So the business of Q equals zero, I think, it's properly incorporated, and it's not a trick that gets back at you. Now, the rest of the Wheeler-DeWitt operator is then an operator which acts on the five-dimensional space of metrics of determinant one. And one can also make, and it's a symmetric space, it has nice properties, one can define the Laplacian on that space. And there is a whole procedure of Fourier analysis on symmetric spaces, so I think the thing is really mathematically well-defined, and it has both incoming waves and outgoing waves, and it permits a treatment which is, I think, bona fide of these things coming into a singularity and then going away from the singularity, just as plane waves do for electrons and positrons. So I think that at least the way we did that, we would have missed several things if we had gone too violently into mini superspace.
Mm.
I understand that that chain of violence with the lapse, which is real scaled, makes things very sweet. But it gets you into the problem Q equals zero. I think that adding more difficulty, which is going into the full non-local theory, also gives you guidance on how to really do the factor ordering so that you don't run into the problem. That's a long statement.
Now, I remember your paper now from many years ago, but I will certainly look at that again.
I think, I'm afraid, in view of time, we need to go to the next door. So apologies.